From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest is film and rock historian David N. Meyer. His book, 20,000 Roads, The Ballad of Gram Parsons and His Cosmic American Music, was acclaimed by the music press as one of the great rock biographies. His new book is a biography of one of the most phenomenally successful rock groups of all time, the Bee Gees. David N. Meyer, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
In your Gram Parsons book, I remember that you mentioned several performers whose voices, you know, have moved you in addition to Graham's. And I think you had Carl Bryan and Dennis, and you had Patsy Cline and Greg Allman and Chet Baker and Alex Chilton. But not on that list were Barry, Robin, or Morris Gibb. And I think you wrote 20,000 Roads out of devotion to Gram Parsons. And Graham kind of appeals to the lovers of eclectic sounds, the type of person who never listens to the Bee Gees.
You know, I think with a quarter of a billion records sold, I think it's almost impossible to say there's a kind of person that never listens to the Bee Gees. You know, they may not, you know, lovingly take their Bee Gees record out of the case and run the brush over it and put the needle down very gently, but you can't live in this world and not hear the Bee Gees.
Well, that's true. And you pointed out in your book how many Bee Gees songs, and I didn't realize it until you said it, how many Bee Gees songs are in our heads and we can't get away from them. They're just there.
They're just there. Like I said in the book, they really are the ether, and they're everywhere. They're inescapable.
But now, were you a Bee Gees fan before you decided to write this book?
Absolutely not. I think that I regarded the Bee Gees as I think everyone except their legion of diehard fans regards them, which is with genial contempt. You know, I liked them. I liked a few songs when I heard them. I thought they were just patently ridiculous. And so this book was a really surprising journey of discovery for me.
Do you find now that you love them?
I find now that they intrigue me very much as people, and that there are certain aspects of their music that I love very much, and there's four or five songs I really love, and maybe 20 or 30 I admire.
Well, I noticed that you only got about 20 pages into your book before Gram Parsons appeared.
Well, can you do?
When you mentioned that his great cover with the Burritos of To Love Somebody.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty sure that I never knew that Barry wrote To Love Somebody, that I always thought that Al Green had written it, because Al Green's version is so astonishing.
Right.
And, you know, Barry wrote it when he was 20 as a song for Otis Redding. And I say in the book it's the greatest Otis Redding song that Otis Redding never recorded. And it's so perfect for Otis's voice and timbre and pacing. And you just can't number the people who've covered it. And I think it really speaks to Barry's genius as a pop songwriter, which is one of the strongest things I came away from this book, is just awe at Barry's gifts, at his ambition, at the range of his abilities, and his longevity.
You don't know what it's like. Baby, you don't know what it's like to love somebody. To love somebody the way I love you. I know you don't know what it's like. Baby, you don't know what it's like to love somebody. To love somebody the way I love you.
Funny how often when we talk about the best harmony singers, we default to families.
The Everly Brothers.
Yes, the Everly Brothers, the Leuven Brothers, the Wilson Brothers, the Love Brothers, the Staple family, the Isley Brothers, the Carter family. I mean, we can go on and on.
Yeah.
And the Bee Gees have a magical harmony that they've had since, you know, they were little bitty boys. And they've always understood instinctually how to sing together since they were little bitty boys. And I think it works for them and against them in that, you know, one thing about the Bee Gees' music is that almost all their songs seem to be these kind of hard, glossy objects that you can't get inside of the way you can get inside a Graham song. You observe them from the outside. And I think that's in the quality of their harmonies, that they're very, very self-contained.
Well, it really is interesting to compare, since you wrote the book about both of them, how you, in your Graham Parsons book, you point out that Graham never sang a song the same way twice.
Right.
Whereas the Bee Gees pretty much sing the song the same way every single time.
Yeah, George Martin, when he was producing the disastrous soundtrack to their version of the Sgt. Pepper's and other Beatles covers, he said something really astute, which was that Barry was too in love with perfection, and that, you know, Barry had just insane perfect pitch and was a technological perfectionist, and Martin was always trying to get him to recognize that soul might take primacy over technique, but Barry never believed that, you know, and so it makes some of their latter material kind of wearing in a way to listen to.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of hit or miss with them, I think. I mean, some of their songs are so great, and then others are really kind of forgettable.
Well, you know, it's axiomatic. Any Bee Gees record will have two, like, amazing songs, and three or four songs that might be interesting or really idiosyncratic or underappreciated, and the rest will be filler. You know, they're not an album band. They are a singles band. And, you know, there's some obscure cuts that people have a fondness for on records like Odessa and Trafalgar, but in their essence, they are a pop band, and it's their pop singles that make them.
And I guess, in fairness, you know, again, comparing Graham Parsons and the Bee Gees, Graham Parsons only lived to be in his early 20s, and he only recorded six albums or something. And, you know, so he doesn't have that gigantic catalog that the Bee Gees have.
No, and, you know, if he had had one 250th of their success, one 500th of their success, I think it might have changed him considerably.
One of the, and I hope readers will look at both your books, because I think they're both excellent. 20,000 Roads is such a marvelous book. And there's a scene toward the end where Graham hears his own song in a jukebox and is so thrilled that someone would put a quarter in a jukebox to hear his song.
Yeah, he was astonished that anybody else other than him and his friends listened to his music. That's the kind of obscurity he labored under. And then you look at the Bee Gees, who, you know, they owned the charts for 18 months worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, they had multiple songs in the top 10 for 18 months. I mean...
Well, was that during the Saturday Night Fever,
yeah.
Fever, yeah.
I'm sorry, yes, during Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting also, I mean, I didn't even really think about the Bee Gees as being in the upper echelon of... You know, that really elite crowd of the Beatles and Elvis and Michael Jackson in terms of sales.
And Garth Brooks, let's not forget.
Oh, yeah, I did forget. Hey, I just forgot again. No, he's great.
250 million records, you know, there's only six, you know, groups and people that have done that. That's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Bee Gees had a number one in 1967. They had a number one in 2001.
Wow.
I mean, a top 10, pardon me, in each year. Who's done that? Not even Madonna can do that. I mean, yeah. For sheer ambition, you know, sheer career aggression, Barry just doesn't have an equal.
We're talking with David N. Meyer, and his new book is called The Bee Gees, a biography. You know, in this wonderful age that we live in now, you know exactly, instantly, what all of your readers think of your book because, you know, people put their reviews up on Amazon.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess you know, you got to be careful because there's, you know, there are people who are devoted to the Bee Gees, just like I'm devoted to the Beatles or... or Graham Parsons. And, you know, so, you know, I didn't know as much about the Bee Gees as I know about the Beatles. So, you know, the Bee Gees book was all new to me, and I found it, you know, fascinating and interesting. But the people who were Bee Gees fans, you've got two kinds of reviews from people.
Right.
You got the five-star review and the angry one-star review.
Right, and the distinguishing characteristic of those reviews is the five-star review people read the book, and the one-star people did not. And Barry, when the book was in process, tweeted that he did not want anybody he knew cooperating with the book, and he didn't want any of the Bee Gees fans reading the book. And this has really been taken up, and innumerable Bee Gees fans have posted against the book. And, you know, it's unbelievably frustrating because nobody took their music as seriously as I have. Nobody's written and listened as I have to their music and really given them a fair shake and talked about what made their music great. But the real Bee Gees berserkers are very against the book.
Now, what did you do specifically in your book that pissed them off so much? Why is Barry anti-Meyer?
Well, Barry has always been an extremely controlling guy, and controlling of his image, controlling of information. And the other two Bee Gees books are just fan books. One was written by it's the authorized Bee Gees fan biography, and the other was written by diehard Bee Gees fans. He just didn't want somebody else telling stories about the band, which really surprised me, but he did not. And he did not want any sort of serious critical appraisal of the band. And all he had to do was say it, and folks are against it. I mean, I said what I think everybody except the diehard fans know, which is they're a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, they're, you know,
I mean, why, what could be ridiculous about bell-bottom satin pants that are like 4 feet wide at the bottom and are hugging the crotch, a shiny crotch in the middle? That's not ridiculous.
Well, everybody dressed like that in disco, but if you look at them during the Carnaby Street era,
yeah,
their clothing, or post-disco, their clothing choices were a disaster. They never really understood anything about their public image. And they always looked, you know, a little goony. You know, they were a little goony looking. But, you know, that's also quite endearing in a certain way, their gooniness and their mass success. I saw what was billed as the first Barry Gibb solo concert at a Hard Rock in Florida, where Barry lives. It was a 6,000-seat arena. And there were grandmothers dancing on every chair holding up their cell phones. I mean, they just worshipped him like a god. And he's making a real comeback now. You know, he's about to tour England. He played some dates in Australia. He's about to tour England.
Is he going to release new music?
That's a very good question. I don't know, but he did a more than credible show. And, you know, in a Vegas session musician-y kind of way.
Uh-huh.
But a more than credible show. I mean, he played for, you know, 90 minutes practically. He's 65 years old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, Paul McCartney is older and does 2.5 hours. But
right.
It's interesting.
But Paul McCartney's...
Yes.
Now, as much of a genetic specimen as Barry is, Paul McCartney is really off the charts.
Paul McCartney is, you know, he's making us all look old and bad because he looks so fantastic.
Yeah,
that's
he terrible. Looks cool. Yeah.
Anyway, it's interesting, too, that you'd mentioned that there's two other books about the Bee Gees. Whereas, you know, the Bee Gees are in that elite group, and there must be, I mean, I think there's more books about the Beatles than there are about Abraham Lincoln. There's, you know, a gajillion books about Elvis and Michael Jackson. It's odd that nobody had written a full-length...
There's six books about Garth Brooks.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder why no one wrote about the Bee Gees before. They're like the Rodney Dangerfield of the upper echelon of rock.
The question is, you know, the question that concerns me is, will the Bee Gees demographic want to read about the Bee Gees? You know, that's the question we're waiting to see.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually don't think they get the respect they deserve, and... you know, they invented the drum loop. Their producer Albie Gallutin and their engineer Carl Richardson and Barry created the first ever drum loop for Stayin' Alive.
Mm-hmm.
One of their drummer's parents got sick. He went back to England. They were recording in France. They recorded one of his one drum impact and created this 20-foot loop of tape that went all over the studio, over mic stands and empty tape reels and back to the master heads.
Right, it was analog then.
Yes, it was analog, and one revolution produced one drum beat. That's why a drum loop is called a loop.
Uh-huh.
Nobody knows that. I think if you listen to Jive Talking, I just think Jive Talking is one of the best singles ever cut. And it's innovative in so many ways, and I think if it came out tomorrow, it'd be number one. You know, it's an amazing song that doesn't seem to age. And if you read reviews of the main course record, it's really interesting how nobody at that time was capable of seeing past their image to hear what they were doing. And I say in the book, songs like Jive Talking have outlasted every song it was accused of imitating. And, you know, you put on Staying Alive, everybody's head starts bobbing. What can you do? You can't not, you know.
Oh, yeah. Any DJ could play that, and the dance floor fills up.
That's right.
Well, what did Rolling Stone magazine or Cream magazine or Crawdaddy magazine make of the Bee Gees at the time?
You know, it's a really interesting question, and my research assistant and I read, like, every Trouser Press, NME, Cream, Crawdaddy, and none of them are in electronic archives. You know, they're in... They're not even microfiche. They're in binders and all these.
They're things. In a pile in my garage. You should come over.
They're in a pile. They always treated them as ridiculous. A couple of the English writers, Simon Firth and another English writer, seemed to understand what they were doing. But once the Bee Gees got pegged as those silly guys, even when Rolling Stone put them on the cover and was hyping Sgt. Pepper's, they never treated with respect, and they never addressed their music in any sort of serious critical terms. And you read, you know, not the Lester Bangs or the Chris Gowles or the Greil Marcuses of that era, but you read, you know, the more mainstream rock critics, like who was ever reviewing for the New York Times at the time, and they're just dead wrong. You know, they're dead wrong, and they don't hear what's going on, and they treat them as a joke and talk about them as being derivative and Las Vegas-y. And their show was Las Vegas-y. They were never rock and rollers, you know. They were pop entertainers. And I think that's how they saw them. I think they would have been very happy in an earlier era playing Vegas and Tuxes all their lives.
You know, you pointed out in the book, and I didn't ever think about this, but unlike any other group contemporary of theirs, you know, the Stones, the Beatles, the Kinks, the Zombies, whoever, they didn't do any cover songs.
No. They're in the whole Bee Gees catalog, however many millions of records that is, there's like three songs that weren't written by the Gibb brothers. I think two by one of their, one by a keyboard player, one by a drummer, one by a guitarist in their band. But they never covered anyone else's material, ever.
Except for the wonderful movie they made.
Right, in which the easily the worst movie ever made, bar none. I mean, if you watch it, you know, Lester Bangs wrote some record, and I don't remember which one. He said, "It's stupid with none of the virtues of stupidity."
Well, the movie we're talking about is the movie version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yeah.
And it was a stupid concept to begin with.
The one highlight that I talk about in the book is that Robin's version of Oh Darlin', which is almost sung at an almost dirge-like pace, is a really great song. He tears it up on Oh Darlin', and it's worth hearing.
We're talking with David Meyer, and his new book is a biography of the Bee Gees, and he's also the author of a fabulous book about Graham Parsons, and he also has a book telling you what movies you should rent that you never heard of. I want to ask you about Andy Gibb. You kind of wait near the end of the book to tell us the Andy Gibb story.
Right.
And I think that actually was one of the things that some of the people who hate your book hated the most.
Well, you know, there's a typo in it in which it identifies his eyes as blue when in fact they were brown.
Uh-oh.
And people just went apey. I mean, they went apey over that. But, you know, I think Andy is a really fascinating tale. You know, he was the first person to have his first three songs hit number one, his or her first three songs hit number one,
wow,
all written by Barry. You know, he was a world star at 19. He was dead when he was 30.
Hmm.
He died of a cardiac condition brought on by heavy cocaine use. He didn't die of a cocaine overdose, as most people think. He had been clean, but he had damaged his heart irreparably. And he had his great affair was with Victoria Principal, you know, the star of Dallas, who now makes an incredible fortune with her cosmetic lines and her books. And he was the kind of walking public train wreck that if he was alive now, he would make so much money, because he was one of the first people to go public with addiction, public with his failure to rehab, public with his heartbreak. He didn't know any other way to do it, and I think he would be such a huge star and so rich today. But back then, the mechanisms for recovery are just not what they're like today, and he was never able to get and stay clean.
The songs that Barry Gibb wrote for his brother Andy, were they kind of throwaway songs, or were they good songs?
The first three hits were very, very good pop songs. I mean, in the kindest possible terms, I find them unlistenable, but they're you know, they're much more sophisticated pop constructions than David Cassidy's or Leif Garrett's hits.
Uh-huh.
And then as time went on and Andy got more intractable and Barry got more meshed in other projects, the sense was that Barry began to pass on to Andy second-rate material, but there was also a concern that Andy was not strong enough to go out and tour, sell these better songs. But Andy's first three songs, I mean, they went to number one. They were strong material.
Was there ever talk of Andy becoming a Bee Gee?
Yeah, there was nothing that Andy wanted more. He wanted to become a Bee Gee, and the brothers weren't that interested in the idea. And then when he finally got kind of seriously clean, then the brothers were sort of condescending to let him in, and the notion is that had he lived, he would have been performing with the Bee Gees. That's what he wanted the most. And he and Barry were very, very, very close. And, you know, he died before it could happen, but Robin and Morris were not that thrilled about him being a Bee Gee. You know, they busted their asses all those years to be a Bee Gee, and they weren't that interested in throwing the doors open to their troubled little brother.
So that must have been an interesting relationship, Andy aside, between the three Bee Gees, because you've got two who are twins, fraternal twins, Morris and Robin, and then you've got Barry. And Barry, this tremendous songwriting talent. Was there competition? What was their relationship like?
Well, I think that the relationship between the brothers is what makes the story fascinating. And that for people who are only marginally interested in the book, if you'll permit me a moment of hype, I think that this tale of how they cope with each other, it's just irresistible, and it's continually interesting. You know, I say in the book that it's axiomatic that people in a band, after a certain period of time, cannot stand one another. That is the nature of band life. And it's axiomatic that anybody who has to deal with their family all the time can't stand their family. And yet here these guys work together for 40 years. And so, yeah, tensions were raised, extreme tensions. And one of the strongest areas of tension was that Barry didn't want Robin to sing lead anymore, even on Robin's own songs. he didn't want anyone else in the spotlight. And, you know, for a long time, Robin was quite a good songwriter. I mean, nothing like Barry, but nobody's like Barry. I mean, Barry's on a par with Paul McCartney, I think, for output and I think that his pop craft is greatly underestimated. But when they sort of semi broke up in the early 70s, it was because Barry didn't want Robin singing lead, and neither did Robert Stigwood, their manager. And so they learned this bitter lesson, all three of them, that none of them could do what they did best without the others.
You know, that's interesting, because in your Graham Parsons book, for a good part of the story, Graham Parsons is a member of the Byrds. And so you take some time to tell the story of the Byrds. And that's one of the things I like about your books, because you also take the time to tell the story of disco in the middle of your Bee Gees book. But when you talk about the Byrds, it's really interesting because, you know, we think of rock bands because the Beatles were the ones that kind of created rock and roll bands as we know them. And Hard Day's Night kind of, you know, cast the mold. And so we think of them as living together and loving each other and grooving together. And then it's kind of just sort of shocking to kind of have everything revealed. And we now know that the Byrds were a business, that they were all, you know, their job was to be the Byrds. They didn't particularly love each other or even like each other that much. And the Byrds went on regardless of who was in the Byrds. So there was that aspect to the Bee Gees also, except for the fact that it had to be them because it was the family.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one thing that's fascinating about the Byrds is how much animosity they generated in such a short time.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the Ramones, you know, the Ramones couldn't stand each other, but the Ramones spent, you know, decades in a van. You know, and so how could they possibly stand each other? But the Byrds hated each other after 6 months.
Well, you know, the 60s was a really compressed time period, wasn't it? I mean, you know, when you think about the fact that the Beatles recorded all of their music in an 8-year period,
right,
and that the Byrds' career, you know, really is pretty short. And considering how many hits and how many variations of the band there are, it was kind of amazing that it happened so quickly. But I think if you, maybe you've talked to David Crosby or people who were involved, you know, I wonder if they look back on that period and think, you know, if we'd known that life was as short as it was, we could have stayed together and made some great music and great money. And
I don't think any of them felt that way, except maybe Gene Clark, you know, and he was so badly treated by the other ones. You know, what was he to do?
Yeah.
I think that the Bee Gees' ambition, you know, their desire to be the biggest pop stars in the world made them put up with one another. You know, lesser bands, people of lesser will, would have just blown it off, and it wasn't like they needed the dough. You know, after Saturday Night Fever, they would never want for money again, to say the least. And while making Saturday Night Fever, the same tensions were there. You know, who's going to sing lead? Whose songs are going to get on the record? And it was always Barry running things. They had resigned themselves to putting up with Barry running things. And, you know, Morris for many, many years was a terrible alcoholic. He got clean and sober before he died. Robin was a devoted amphetamine addict for most of his life. He got clean before he died. Barry doesn't seem to have been much of a drug user. But as they say, you know, when everyone in the band is on different chemicals, you're going to get dissension. And yet they put up with each other and thrived and learned to they found a workable dynamic. And very few other bands have.
It really is an absolutely fascinating story, and it sits on my shelf right next to my 20,000 Roads, The Ballad of Graham Parsons. And the book is called The Bee Gees, A Biography, the author David N. Meyer. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. And you can find us on Facebook. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, David N. Meyer. His new book, The Bee Gees, A Biography. You might also want to check out his book, 20,000 Roads, The Ballad of Graham Parsons. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.